Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 168, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And welcome to this week's show. Now, today, we've got so much that we need to cram into this 1 hour-ish that this podcast is going to last this week. Not only are we going to cover one company that changed the face of British video games back in the day, not just two, but in fact three huge companies with our guest this week, Tim Chaney. Now, one of them is the company that was responsible for bringing, do you remember those really glamorous games that we'd hear about in America? Stuff like, you know, summer games and winter games and arcade stuff like, you know, Gauntlet and Outrun. Today, we're going to be talking about US Gold.
They were the all-American software company, weren't they? They kind of bought the stuff over, converted it for our home systems and got that wider market.
And it was crazy because, I mean, you think stuff like, you know, Outrun, that was like a smash hit arcade title when that came out.
Oh, huge, yeah.
And the challenge of getting that running on like something like, you know, a ZX Spectrum. But they managed it, you know, and they brought all these huge titles to our home. And then we're going to go into probably the biggest example of 90s hedonism in the British video games industry, Virgin Games.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were Virgin, weren't they? They were such a cool company, originally started with the Sex Pistols, you know, they were really cool. And the games that they produced, my God, the quality of them. Beneath the Steel Sky was an absolutely fantastic one, but also The Lion King. Yeah. That's one of my favourite games. I was playing it actually last night.
Well, other stuff there, Race Cannon Fodder, you know, Seventh Guest as well, that came out on Virgin. But think about it, I mean, you've got to remember the 90s here in Britain, and it's a bit hard to explain for people that might live outside the UK what it was like living here in the 90s. I mean, we had stuff like, you know, lads magazines.
Well, it was cool Britannia, wasn't it? It was really popping off in the 90s. It isn't so much now, but we're hoping for that again.
Well, I mean, the stories I've read about Virgin, the fact that, you know, maybe they used to bribe video games reviewers to get good reviews by including little packets of drugs inside releases of games.
Well, these were a wild kind of early on anti-establishment kind of stuff. And, you know, Virgin, when you'd go in there, it would be your full solution. You'd be able to go in there. You'd probably be able to buy some clothing merchandise, buy your favourite record, go downstairs, buy your computer game, and then buy a book on the history of the Sex Pistols or something. It's like your full kind of 90s media outlet, wasn't it, really?
Well, Tim's actually written a few stories about Virgin. The overarching title is, you know, sex, drugs and video games. So, you know, we're going to get all those stories. And also Tim worked at Commodore as well, you know, in the UK.
Like, yeah, we do talk a lot about Commodore, but yeah.
But talking about, you know, the fact when he, you know, was out there marketing the VIC-20, you know, those early days too.
Yeah, so there wasn't even a market there, was
no,
there?
No, had to create it from scratch. So a really interesting guest this week, Tim Chaney, the story of Commodore in the UK, US Gold and Virgin Games, all coming up on the Retro Hour podcast. He'll be on in around 15 minutes from now. Now, you did mention Beneath a Steel Sky there as well, and people may have seen this online, that there's actually a sequel finally coming out all these years later that we need to talk about in just a minute. And also, we're going to chat about playing Nintendo GameCube games in virtual reality. This is now a thing. Now, before we get into this week's show, we always start by giving a big thank you to the people who support the podcast and allow us to keep coming here, bringing you amazing guests and giving you the retro gaming news every single week of the year. And they are our loyal donators. Now, if you'd like to get involved, we accept PayPal donations of any amount. And of course, it all goes back into the running of the show. And you can find that on the front page of our website. Click on the supporters link at theretrohour.com. And for doing that, you will earn your place in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame and get a mention on a future episode. Like this week,
Gary Hever,
Jason Herrick,
Alex Vasic,
and Espen Gulbeck, who all made donations into the running of the show. Thank you so much, guys. It really means a lot to us. And if you'd like to do the same, you can find all that information on our website at theretrohour.com. Now, let's give another mention to a big supporter of the podcast, as at the moment, you'll know that WrestleMania is on.
Yeah, I saw actually that it was the first WrestleMania to actually have three female main wrestlers, basically.
I've got friends that are like really into wrestling, like my buddy Ian, who's actually in the next room from us now. He pulled an all-nighter, you know, to watch the start of WrestleMania. Yeah. It's like such a big thing. And you probably remember, I mean, we're talking last week about in the early 90s, the height of WWF and games like WrestleFest as well, that was, you know, a massive arcade game. I remember putting so many, like, you know, 10, 20 P's into that at the seaside with my friends back in the day.
Yeah, because we were talking about it last week and we actually mentioned one of the characters. It was a clown with loads of little guys. One of our listeners actually got in contact and said it was Doink the Clown.
That was it. We're here for half an hour before who was it again. Well, the reason we're talking about wrestling is, of course, WrestleMania is on right now, but also the Retro Hour podcast this month to celebrate WrestleMania. We're brought to you by our good friends at RetroSoft Studios, who are supporting us this month because they've got an amazing new retro wrestling game coming out called RetroMania Wrestling. Now, this is, technically, it's a spiritual successor to the 1991 arcade game WrestleFest. And you're talking all the things that made WrestleFest amazing. Pick up and play arcade games, 2D sprites, amazing backgrounds, fast-paced arcade-style gameplay. And there is going to be 12 to 16 wrestlers that are playable at launch. Now, we mentioned a few last week as well, but they've actually added a few more to the roster this week as well. Blue World Order, Stevie Richards, Hollywood Nova, and the Blue Meanie have all been added to the lineup too. So if you want to find out more about this, the game's in development right now. And we say, you know, if you love those old school wrestling games, have a look at it. You've got to check out their website, RetroManiaWrestling.com. You can follow them on Twitter at RetroSoft Studio. And of course, we'll put a link in our show notes if you want to find out more about this game. Give it a look. You know, if you love those old school games and you'd be helping out the podcast, you find those links in our show notes at TheRetroHour.com.
I really kind of love how they're getting these old titles and adding new features and kind of bringing them back for the modern age, but still retaining all that old schoolness.
And the stuff that, you know, in there that you couldn't do back in the day as well, which I love. It's kind of, you know, it does retain that legacy of those games that you did love back then, but also kind of putting a new spin on it and stuff that you thought, I wish I could have done that back in 1991. So yeah, definitely do check them out. Now, let's get into Beneath a Steel Sky. It came out in 1994 originally, didn't it?
Yeah, and this was a fantastic point-and-click adventure. I absolutely loved it, and I remember having the speech version. It was very slow on the Amiga CD32, but if you had a PC version, it's much nicer. And it was very funny, actually.
Yeah.
It was a hilarious game. It was set in a cyberpunk world, and I always remember that little Joey kind of robot following you, and you had to build him up out of scrap. I think that's about as far as I ever got.
You had to put him in like a vacuum cleaner shell or something, yeah. I think, didn't you, if I remember rightly. But yeah, that game, I was a huge fan of it as well. It was kind of very, a bit kind of a dystopian future, a bit 1984, a bit kind of Blade Runner, wasn't it? And I think I first played it when I got the Amiga Format put a demo on their cover disc. And it was kind of the first level. Do you remember that bit where you're at the top and like the security guard comes in and there's a big like crunchy machine and they're trying to find you and you hold onto a back of a door and you hide away from them? And like you said, it had such good atmosphere. And you mentioned the talkie version then. I was playing that probably last summer because with WHD load now, you can put the whole file on there. You don't have to wait for the CD access times and everything.
Oh.
And it's a really compelling story, very good. But now, all these years later, 25 years on from the original, we're getting a sequel. Now, this is called Beyond a Steel Sky. Ah. And it's by Revolution Software, who were actually the team behind the original.
Yeah, because we had Steve Ince on the show as well. And this is Charles Cecile, who was the main designer of Beneath a Steel Sky originally.
Now, this new game, I mean, they've only put out like a minute-long trailer, and it's got some really interesting art style. I mean, it's got, you know, that kind of comic book style. It's by Dave Gibbons, who did all the background art for the original game as well. So, you know, it does kind of retain that kind of feel. The only thing is, it's very different to the original.
Yeah, I've been looking at it, and to me, this looks more of the kind of Fortnite, No Man's Sky, modern kind of style of animation.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look very cyberpunky to me. But then, I don't know, this could be early shots or you know, it might work.
Yeah, it's the original. The thing,
I'm too pixel strong.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. I think a lot of people were expecting it to be kind of a Thimbleweed Park kind of, you know, new point and click game, which, you know, we've talked about it before, that genre has had a bit of a comeback in recent years. But this isn't. I mean, this is, it looks like it's kind of a third person game, isn't it?
It is. And you know what I'm going to say? I'll probably regret this. But it reminds me of those really bad Syndicate trailers that you used to get in the days, like Syndicate Wars and stuff like that, or the latest remakes of Syndicate. But I just... maybe with a different texture pack, it could completely, or even different colour settings, it could completely change the whole thing. I think it needs to be darker. That's my vision of cyberpunk, yeah.
Well, it's getting a bit of a mixed reaction online, and I think a lot of people are disappointed that, yeah, okay, it's not a point-and-click game, kind of, you know, a direct success to the original.
But we are also talking about a 50-second trailer here. That's all we've seen of the game, you know.
Yeah, and it could be. I mean, the thing about these games is, I think the story's what makes it. You know, the medium of how you play the game can kind of become irrelevant when you get into the story.
And once you get the humour going and you get the kind of, and the connection with the characters. And obviously with Charles on board, this is going to be part of it. You know?
And we haven't really seen any of the story or anything yet. Like you said, it is literally that one kind of 1 minute trailer. And there are quite a lot of negative comments on the YouTube video now. You know, a little disclaimer here, we did invite the guys onto the show. We've been in touch with them and invited them on for a chat. They didn't get back to us. So, you know, we're having to kind of go from what we've seen in articles and that kind of thing.
But, you know, they're saying that this is actually a comic book styled graphics for 4K and HDR. So it is a full targeted kind of thing. And, you know, this could be something completely new.
Yeah, and
we never know.
Well, I think, you know, when we do get, I'm confident that they can deliver a good story. And providing you can actually play the game and it's immersive, I don't really think it's a big deal that it's changed kind of genre, as it were. You know, it's not point and click anymore. It's now a third person adventure
game. And there's some nice looking stuff also in the trailer, but just stuff like he's got bots following him or small creatures. There might be interactivity with the environment. He's got tools and pieces of equipment that seem a lot more interactive than it did in the point of click. So you've probably got a lot more options of how to play.
But yeah, it's a 2019 video game.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And there is going to be nods in there as well to fans of the original. I'm sure Joey will make an appearance, for example. So I think we wait and see. I think it's great that it's getting a sequel. I mean, I love Beneath the Steel Sky.
I think that's great. Yeah. You know, the worst thing they could have done would just be leave it. You know, even if nobody likes this in the end, maybe they'll remaster the original. You never know. I don't know.
The only bit I'm a bit curious about is apparently it's coming out, they've revealed it's going to be released on Apple Arcade. So far they've only announced iOS and Apple TV as the platforms.
But if you think about that mobile platforming, how big that is as well, like iPads and stuff like that, it might be aim for that. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it'll eventually get ported to Switch and PS4 and all that. Yeah. So maybe it's a bit of an Apple exclusive at first. But yeah, I must admit, I don't game quite all that heavily on my Apple TV. No. I must say. So we'll keep an eye on it. And if the guys do get back to us, we'll have them on to talk
a bit
more about it.
Get your Pippin out.
I'd love a Pippin, actually. I've seen the show. Not many games to play. You know me, though. I love those awful failed consoles. Yeah,
I like the controllers. They look weird.
Yeah, they're actually not that bad, the controllers. But I don't think there's many games that you can play on them. But yeah, that is kind of a little gap in my collection at the moment. Now, one system that was a great console back in the day, the Nintendo GameCube. Some amazing titles on that system. Even the Wii. I mean, I was never a fan of the Wii's method of control. I hated the Wiimotes. But, I mean, there is some really good, often undiscovered titles on the Wii. I think it's not really a... Maybe it's an age thing. It hasn't quite crossed over into retro yet, and maybe a lot of the games on there don't quite get the respect that they deserve. Yeah. It does feel a bit of kind of an untapped kind of market sometimes. But you've talked to me before about this Dolphin emulation suite. Now, this is an open source emulator that can run GameCube, it can run Wii games. But now they figured out a way to get GameCube games running in virtual reality.
Yeah, so this is absolutely insane. I'm using a HTC Vive at the moment, and I've found a program that I recommend to everybody, which is called Revive, which basically is a like compatibility layer that works with the Oculus stuff.
Okay.
So I can run all the Oculus stuff. So I was like, okay, this has got a compatibility layer. So what they've done is they've made one of these for Dolphin, which is the GameCube emulator. So what it will probably do is project two pictures in each eye and really puts you inside the game. But also, interestingly, it skins your HTC Vive controllers with little Nintendo GameCube-looking kind of skins in the virtual reality. And you have the buttons, it turns into a D-pad and stuff like that. It looks really interesting. There's a review here on PC Gamer, and there's been a lot of videos of guys using Mario Kart, which was sent by Atronic, one of our listeners on Discord. He actually sent that. But there's a article here on PC Gamer which is talking about how all these different games are now supporting it. So they talk about the experience with Metroid Prime.
And that was a first-person shooter, wasn't it?
Yeah, F-Zero, and Pikmin is supposed to be awesome with it.
See, Pikmin, I love Pikmin anyway. Pikmin 3 was the last one I played on the Wii U. That needs to come out on the Switch, you know, because that's such a good game. That's kind of a, it's a puzzle game where you get these little aliens and you've got to make them do different things. But, I mean, you think all these games that did come out in that era on the GameCube, they were mostly all 3D games. So yeah. I guess, you know, I can kind of see why they would probably lend themselves quite well to running in virtual reality.
It's crazy, though, to think about it, isn't it? Because, yeah. you know, you could do this emulation layer on like loads of different pieces of software, WinUAE, or you could have it on any kind of emulator and then enter your old game and play it from a completely new perspective.
Yeah, with that original code. I mean, what's interesting is, I mean, I'm looking at this article on PC Gamer, and I was a bit sceptical when you sent this article. I thought, oh yeah, you know, it might work, but I bet it's an awful experience. But they've gone on about how good it actually is and how they didn't expect it to actually work this well.
That was crazy. When I installed the Revive, I thought, okay, I'm emulating something here. This isn't, you know, there's going to be a little bit of lag. There wasn't a frame of lag between any of it. So it's fantastic, yeah. And obviously, it's actually going to be a lot less demanding than what you're actually probably doing in VR anyway. So if you run that stuff, I'm sure you can run a couple of GameCubes at the same time.
And that's one thing I do love about the emulation scene, the fact that they can give you new ways to experience your favourite games and play them in ways that you never dream possible.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Or the way that they're kind of fitting new technologies to emulate us now, like PlayStation 2 ones with anti-aliasing added on top of it and all these extra bloom effects and HD textures. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, scaling Pong up to 4K.
Yeah, I saw 4K... Oh, what was it? GTA 3 last night, and guys were going around. And I was like, it's 4K, but you still can't swim in the water.
Yeah. Yeah, there are still some limitations in there, but it looks a really cool project. And there's actually a little tutorial on Reddit of how to get it all up and running and everything. So I'll put a link to all that.
I've got to give it a go.
Oh, you so do. And let us know next week what you think of it.
Vomit everywhere after Mario Kart.
Yeah, Mario Kart can send me a bit dewy eyed at the best of times.
Get hit by her shell. See what happens.
Yeah, Reddit comes with a bruise on his back. What happened? It was a bit too realistic.
Run into a wall.
So if you want to find out how to get that up and running, I'll put the story and all the links in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into the story of US Girl, Virgin, Commodore UK with Tim Chaney, let's talk a bit about a website from back in the day and an interesting article that the BBC have actually been running this week. They're talking about the million-dollar homepage.
Yeah, because the main thing that they're talking about is kind of why there's so little left of the internet. Now, we talked about the old Net the other day, which was a website that looked through the archive stuff. But, you know, they're saying, people saying, oh, I'm going to archive my pictures by putting them on Facebook. That's not archiving it because Facebook might not be here.
Oh, look at Google Plus.
Exactly. That's exactly what they're saying. Look at Google Plus. And they're talking about one website in particular, which I really remember and I'm really nostalgic about, which was the Million Dollar Homepage, which was the idea in the 90s that we all wished we'd had.
Yeah, well, this was 2005 it launched, because I remember my friend Paul and I, just after uni, we were looking at this website thinking, first of all, like you said, wish we came up with that idea. But I remember us watching that every day, it'd refresh, and it'd come through, and you'd be like, oh, someone else is on there now, look, they filled that square there. And we'd see it gradually filling up.
Yeah, so the idea of this site was, it was basically a million pixels of ad space, and each pixel was in, like, you'd buy blocks of 100 at $1 per pixel.
Yeah.
So eventually the owner would have $1 million. And you'd think, oh, well, that wouldn't really work. People wouldn't advertise in it. But what happened was, it just started getting so many hits, and the idea started spreading so much that it turned into this huge image, which is actually quite beautiful if you look at it now.
Well, people bought
multiple. You spot all the 90s kind of stuff. It's just like dating in big letters.
Well, they, because a lot of companies did buy like several pixels, didn't they? So it wasn't, you know, the adverts weren't all limited to one pixel. But yeah, looking through, you had stuff like cheapflights.com, the Times newspaper, Yahoo, Tenacious D.
HostGator in here, and Where's Wally in the middle of it, you know?
So it was a snapshot of, 2005 on the web, really. But and the website's still up if you want to check it out. But the reason this ties in is a saying, how many of them on there? You click on them and like they take you to dead links now, probably half of the website. Because Yeah, we talked about the old net.com and, you know, the Wayback Machine. And the Internet Archive only really archived from about, well, they say 96 in here, but there is some sites come back to about 94. Mm. But, I mean, there was sites running for a couple of years before that we don't have images of.
But also, if you think of this, this is the kind of start of, like, crowdfunding in a way. Because after this, I remember iPods came out and there was all these students that would go, oh, I really like an iPod. I've never seen one. What a beautiful device. And they'd write a blog about it. And then suddenly all these Apple fanboys would have sent them the money for an iPod. And that was the real kind of start of, like, supporting and, actually being able to get something out to the internet.
And the early days of stuff going viral, really.
Yeah, and going viral, definitely.
Because I remember, I think, you know, we found out about the million-dollar homepage because, you know, there's no Facebook, not even MySpace was around then, you know, in the mainstream at least anyway. And I remember you'd get, like, an email off a friend and he'd be like, check this page out. And he'd look down and it'd have, like, you know, all the forwards of everyone else that it had been sent to.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, at the bottom of the email.
Like huge chain letters.
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was crazy. So... And they do make a good point that there is kind of a lot of the very early web, you know, maybe talking like 92, 93, 94, that is missing from the archives. But what I do think, and I've noticed this, is archive.org need to make it easier for you to submit your old websites to them. Because I've got a few on like old CD-ROMs and stuff. I thought, well, they haven't got captures of this. But it's a bit difficult to actually send them to them.
Like if you talk, when we talked to Jason Scott in our interview, he mentioned that he had so much stuff that he just hasn't been able to process. That's the thing. So there may be tons of stuff. He was talking about how he had half a Twitter. Like, you know, there's tons of stuff out there. But I guess just the time alone to process it and how much that costs to do and all of this kind of stuff compared to having to work and live your life, you know.
Well, I guess he is trying to archive the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a small job, I guess, thinking about it. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm sure over time these gaps will get completed and, you know, but I just think there is stuff I've got on there. I mean, there probably is a way, but it'd just be nice if I could go, I've got an image of this site from 1992, let's upload it. You know,
we just need to find old Dan's old letters to the Amiga magazine.
Nobody wants to read that. So if you want to find out more about that, maybe have a little look at the million-dollar homepage and get all nostalgic, I'll link that up and everything else we've talked about at theretrohour.com. Now, before we chat to Tim Chaney, just a little reminder, do go and check out Retro Mania Wrestling. They are supporting the Retro Hour podcast this week. The spiritual successor to the 1991 arcade game WrestleFest, with this brilliant new game from RetroSoft Studios. Now, their entire studio is built on putting a retro spin on modern games. And this looks wonderful. I mean, I'm going to share a few shots, actually, because they put stuff out on Twitter all the time, kind of in the, you know, the development of what it looks like now. Check out Twitter and Facebook. I'll post a few on there, too, because how much fun does this look?
Yeah, yeah, the artwork looks fantastic as well. It's really popping. And the different modes, like, I kind of like seeing a cage there.
Exactly, and 12 to 16 playable wrestlers at launch. We mentioned a few last week, Hawk and Animal of the Road Warriors, Tommy Dreamer, Austin Idol, Zack Sabre Jr. So if you want to get a little look at this game in development and also kind of keep up with where it's going, if you're a big fan of wrestling and you love WrestleFest, I mean, you've got to check this out. And of course, it goes without saying, you'll be helping the podcast as well. We really appreciate their support. So their website is retromaniawrestling.com and follow them on Twitter at RetroSoft Studio. Right then, let's get the history of Commodore UK, US Gold, and Virgin Games with this week's special guest, Tim Chaney. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for the main event then. Time to get this week's special guest on, getting stories about some of the most infamous companies in British computing and video games, Commodore, US Gold, and then Virgin Games as well. So many stories that we're going to cram into this hour. Let's welcome on this week's guest. It's our pleasure to say hello to Tim Chaney.
Good morning to you guys.
Hey Tim, how are you doing?
Pretty good. As ready as I'll ever be for this walk down memory lane.
Well, we've got a lot to cram into this hour. I mean, your story, I mean, let's kind of start it when you joined Commodore in 1981. Now, I was reading the section that you wrote in David Pleasance's book about your time at Commodore. And I know you started there when they originally started their home computer division, selling the VIC-20. But the job interview didn't go quite as smoothly as you expected then.
Yeah, I mean, I only tell that story because it may be an inspiration to others, in so much that at the time I was selling automotive chemicals. You know, our major brand was T-Cut, which I'm sure you've used on your car to restore the colour at some point in your life. And, you know, the Bible of the day to look for jobs was called the grocer. I'm not even sure it's still around now, maybe, because that's where you got the FMCG jobs, fast-moving consumer goods jobs. And there was a job advertised to Commodore, no idea who they were, selling a home computer, no idea what that was. But the job had the title of regional sales manager, which sounded really good, and it had a Ford Cortina. And as a salesman, you know, what you're looking for, title and car.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically it. So I was invited to an interview. I went to see, it was in a hotel which is now called something else, but it was called the Spider's Web at the time on the Watford bypass, to meet Paul Welsh. And it was one of those, it was really an ugly, ugly interview. I mean, he was just ripping into me about my CV and, you know, I mean, how can you go into computers? You're selling, you know, chemicals now. And anyway, it was one of those interviews that, you know, the second you walk out the door, you know, you completely block it out because you think, what a waste of time. You know, I didn't think any more of it. I really did. Between moving out of the hotel, getting in my car, you know, I'd forgotten about it. And a couple of weeks later, I was at home and there was a call. And I answered it, and he said, "Hi, it's Paul." When really I'd blocked it so well, I couldn't remember who he was, right? And he said, "Paul Welsh, Commodore, we met a couple of weeks ago." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's a strange one. Didn't expect this call, whatever it's about. It may be just to ring me up, tell me I've got the worst CV he's ever seen in his life, and he wanted to stick the knife in." And he said, yeah. He said, "We met a couple of weeks ago in Watford." I said, yeah. He said, "I'd like to offer you the job." And I said, "What? You know, you'd like to offer me the job? It was a terrible interview. You did nothing but harangue me for 45 minutes. He said, yeah. He said, "That's what I do with everybody. But out of all the people that I interviewed that day, you were the only guy that fought back."
No way.
And I did, because I thought, well, I'm going to get this job anyway. This guy from the north is, you know, it's giving me a hard time, so I've got nothing to lose. And, you know, in the words of Bob Dylan, if you've got nothing, you've got nothing to lose. So I thought, well, I'm going to give some back here. And I got the job, which was a complete shock to me. And then I had to look at some magazines to see what a computer was.
Well, obviously in 1981, I mean, Jack Tramiel was still running Commodore. Yeah. And what was it kind of like working for Jack's Commodore then? I heard he had stuff like, you know, 10-point code booklets that you had to follow and that kind of thing.
Jack's philosophy, I'm calling Jack as if I knew him intimately. I didn't, of course. I once saw him and was so scared I kind of went to the toilet or something. You know, was one, I mean, he had this kind of 10-point thing of which business is war. You don't have competitors. You only have enemies, and your job's to crush them. And obviously treat every penny like it's your own, which is a pretty obvious one from an Auschwitz survivor. And I think they took the view that, you know, the VIC-20 and then the 64 that came afterwards was a kind of fad thing. It wasn't a serious long-term business. So while they had kind of brand-leading computers, our position was incredibly hard, incredibly intolerant, and just downright aggressive. I mean, you know, we gave no quarter. I mean, you know, so we had a very hard attitude, because I think they thought, well, you know, this business will be over in a couple of years and then we'll go back to making pets.
Well, you were selling the VIC-20. Was there kind of an existing model for selling a computer in Britain, or did you have to kind of create that from scratch?
Well, we absolutely created it, because at the time there was no home computers in retail in the UK. You know, you had the ZX81. That was a hobby, you know, kit-based machine. You had the 82 that came out, you know, around the time of the VIC-20, or, you know, but no, we were complete pioneers. We were knocking on every door, Boots and Smiths and Tesco's and some retailers that were around then that aren't around now, like Wigfalls and the Co-op, and, well, the Co-op's still around, I know, in a different shape. And, you know, we were just saying, you know, do you want to sell computers? And it was really a cottage industry. It was just starting. And, yeah, I mean, we do every account that probably, I think I'm right in saying this, every retail account that ever sold a home computer started with the VIC-20.
Well, what did you think of the C64 when it came around?
Well, as you know, I mean, the C64 was an absolute game changer. Yeah, it started off that we got some in just before Christmas, which would have been Christmas 82, I guess. And, you know, basically for a week, instead of selling, on the road selling, we were just delivering one per store. That's a demo unit, you know, for what was to come. And, I mean, it was, as you know, it's a quantum leap. It was kind of being pitched at the time. It's like a half business, half fun. I mean, but as we know, it became all fun, all games around the world. And, you know, numbers differ, whether they come from Jack Tramiel or they come from other sources. But it sold about 20 million over its kind of three-year span. It was number one in the UK, without a shadow of doubt, Germany, the lowland, low countries. It was just, it was a fantastic machine. And you got the first great games, really, really good-looking games that came out of it, mainly from America because they were working on discs. But also the UK games business really started with the Commodore 64 and the Spectrum. And later came Alan Michael, you know, with his concoction. He sold about 3 million. Games were serious, you know, getting serious at last. But it's still, you've got to take it in context. When we think about the industry now, and it's this $116 billion dollar, you know, global industry, at the time it was still perceived as a kind of cottage industry. I mean, it was still not serious. I mean, now it's bigger than music and it's bigger than film and video.
Well, one of your clients then was Jeff and Anne Brown at Centresoft in Birmingham. How did that lead to you working at US Gold then?
I left the company, went to Computers, who had a machine called the Lynx. Better car, better title. We couldn't sell it in England, so I got international orders. I had about £3 million pounds of orders, but the company couldn't make the product. You know, one of those kind of, you know, cash flow things. So I thought, well, you know, there's no future here. Even, you know, so I went back. So I called Paul and said, this isn't working for me. And you know, I met him at the services in Newport Pagnell on Sunday morning on his way back to the north. And he said, well, you know, we want you back. You know, Paul liked me. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those kind of lucky things in life. He liked me. And I'd been promoted a couple of times. And he said, but we've only got software. Anyway, so I went back to try and sell the software. And at the time, the customers were the normal ones. But there was Centresoft and there was Tiger and there was Webster's and there was Micro Dealer. They were the kind of the big distributors at the time. And so I went up to Jeff in Tipton before he, you know, moved to, you know, Holford Way and everything else. And he basically said, look, Tim, I don't know anything about Commodore software, really. You tell me what, you know, you think I should have and just send it and send an invoice. Well, of course, to a salesman that worked for Commodore, that was like manna from heaven.
Yeah.
So I basically emptied the warehouses. Excuse me. I emptied the warehouses and sent them down to him. And he didn't complain, actually. He paid the bill. It was just a Commodore thing that we took our best customers out for Christmas dinner, you know. So I went to have dinner with the Jeff and Anne in Birmingham, and you know the usual stuff. And then Anne turned around, you know, she was much more direct and forthright, and you know, she made her point. Said, would you like to join us? I said, well, yeah, but I'm really a kind of hardware guy, you know. I mean, I'm not software guy. And at the time, you know, US Gold had only released Beachhead. I say only, it was an incredible product. But that was it. And I said, but why me? You know, why me? And she said that you're the only person that's ever stitched us up. So we want you on our side, stitching up everyone else. So, I left. I mean, that was the second time I left Paul, and actually the third, because I was going to join Lightning Records at one point as sales director. And he made an offer at the last second, even though they'd already bought the company car for me. So I joined in January 85.
Well, that was around the time they're getting ready to release Raid Over Moscow. And I heard that you had a bit of a run-in with some protesters when you joined US Gold and that game.
Because, I mean, I don't think it was the first day I turned up. It's certainly the first week. It's a miserable kind of half snowy, soggy day. And when I turned up, there was a load of protesters outside the building with they were campaigning for nuclear disarmament, and they were protesting about raid over Moscow. One of the journalists called me up, and I said, "Come on, okay." I said, "Come on, it's a game. It's like cowboys and Indians. You know, when we were young, it's now, you know, the Cold War. You know, it's the head of the CND at the time was Monsignor Bruce Kent, and he was interviewed in the same article, and he called me a horrible little man for my comment. So it was interesting start to the job.
Well, talking about US gold, I mean, I remember, you know, seeing adverts for US gold and reading about the company, and it always seemed that, you know, you're bringing these big, glamorous American titles over to the UK. I mean, what was kind of the philosophy behind the company?
I mean, it started with one very, very simple idea that Jeff had, so I take no credit for that at all. He was a distributor, and he saw all these, some Commodore 64 games on disc in America. You know, in England, we couldn't give away the disc. You know, it's about the size of a fridge. It was £400 or something ridiculous like that. I mean, nobody bought them. And we had a cassette business, you know, so basically went to the States, went to publishers and said, well, look, give us your disc game, you know, and we'll put it out in cassettes in the UK. And it was as simple as that. You know, sometimes that required 8 cassettes, as you can imagine. And, you know, the first games that came through, like Beachhead, Raid Over Moscow, Dam Busters, and several were just really big hits. And then we got Epics later. And then we converted them to Spectrum and Amstrad. And I think really very, very quickly, after by like 83, we had like 80% of all the software in America, Commodore 64 software in America at US Gold, because we paid advances. We paid royalties, and at the time, you know, the US market was, you know, so big, huge, and Europe was, you know, whatever, you know, it's almost like a little add-on, so they didn't kind of care. You know, nowadays, obviously, it's just, you know, it's as important as America, almost, and there was no China or anything like that in those days. So that was the idea. I mean, it was as simple as that, and we just signed up everything, and what we promised people was, which obviously battered us a bit in our reputation, is we signed up whole catalogs. We didn't cherry pick, you know, and we had an obligation to kind of release everything. So, you know, alongside a game that's absolutely fantastic, you may have 3 complete, you know, dogs, but we had to release them and we had to market them, which gave us this kind of incredible output, of which, you know, some of it was, you know, I mean, suspect is saying it lightly and should never see the light of day. But that was what we offered people. And it was compelling for US publishers at the time.
Well, you were saying the US market was a lot bigger than the British one. Were the standard of games higher than the British games?
Well, the Commodore 64 certainly were. Yeah, I mean, yeah, a lot. But the UK was picking up. The UK, I say the UK because at the time, really, the UK was the only country in Europe that had a decent, you know, development community. There were some in Germany, but the rest you can forget. I mean, that was it. Some UK, and so the UK was getting better and better, and kind of catching up. But it was really kind of the graphics. I mean, the graphics in the C64 products from America were just better. You know, I mean, and it took the UK games development, you know, sector, you know, a long time to catch up with that, and sometimes never did, quite frankly.
Well, now another company that kind of started doing this kind of thing around a similar time. I mean, Elite was a much rivalry between US Gold and
Well, because they're in Warsaw on top of a fish and chip shop, which I always throw in. There wasn't really until they got Commando from Capcom and Ghouls and Ghosts. Because by then, in 86-ish, 86, 87, you know, the coin-op conversion business had started. And somehow they got into Capcom and got these two products out of Capcom. And they were both really, really big hits. So that really, we didn't like that much. And then we obviously went after all the Japanese video game companies. And eventually we got every product from Capcom. So we were out to destroy them, yeah. But then we had an attitude, which I'm not saying I took with me from Commodore, but kind of Anne certainly had. We had an attitude of, you know, we wanted to destroy everybody. And Jeff famously said in one interview that he didn't know why everybody else bothered to make games. You know, so that was our kind of, that was our position. You know, our biggest rival, of course, was Ocean. I mean, Elite popped in, you know, occasionally, but it's just because they're, you know, local. But we didn't want anybody else in Birmingham making games.
Well, what was day-to-day life like at US Gold? Because it must have been a mad place to work, especially if you're getting whole catalogues of games and having to release them all out in quick succession.
Well, it was. I used to get there very early. At the time, I was living in Newport Pagnell, and used to get up in Birmingham at 8 o'clock in the morning, because traffic and Spaghetti Junction and everything else just got a nightmare. And Jeff was always in about the same time. And most mornings, you know, before, you know, 8:05, Jeff would have five new ideas, of which, you know, maybe one was a good one. That's not knocking him, because, you know, he was very creative at the time, and, you know, he came up with some stuff. You know, nearly every day there was probably a good idea that we should be thinking about or doing or following up or, you know, everything else. I mean, life was, I mean, in the end, by 89, it got kind of boring, but, you know, in the early days, it was just a question of that, you know, we were out to conquer. And our sister company was Centresoft. And in the same period that US Gold grew to be kind of number one in the UK and Europe, Centresoft grew to be number one in the UK and Europe. You know, so we had the power of a distributor tied to us. I mean, so we were in an incredibly advantageous position. Not only would we see every product that was presented to Centresoft, if we wanted to, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time doing that, quite frankly, but we had, you know, their sales team pushing our products, you know, putting some other products, you know, a little, you know, behind us and doing deals and up, you know, so we had this kind of awesome power of, you know, some great games and some dogs, and the distribution facility in Centresoft. But life was, you know, pretty much like the office, you know. I'm not saying I was David Brent, but it was it's pretty normal. It was very it's process driven. We were probably, you know, a lot more professional early on than most of the, what we were called at the time, software houses, you know. So, you know, and we were building and building, and you know, it's always fun to be building. You know, that's the best part of, I think, life, is when you're trying to build something and you're being successful at it, and it makes you want more and more.
We did kind of touch on Epics before, and I remember, you know, when Summer Games and Winter Games came out, I mean, they were huge. I mean, was that like a game changer for US Gold when those titles came out?
Well, when I talk about the graphics earlier conversation, you know, I think obviously there's a lot of games, but I had Epics in the back of my mind because, you know, the Epics products, like you said, Summer Games, Winter Games, World Games, just looked... they looked like they were from the future. I mean, they were just so great, and they played so great. Epics was, we didn't get the whole of Europe for Epics. We had their agents kind of broke it up. You know, somebody in Germany, somebody in Benelux, and us in the UK, and a few odds and sods, Australia, and a few bits and pieces. But for the UK, it was just the best brand we handled. You know, it just changed everything. I mean, you know, when you saw something like Summer Games, what was a UK Commodore 64 development company going to do to compete with that? Nothing. I mean, you just couldn't. So it's just a question of how big the market was. Our only constraint was it's still a cottage industry. You know, if it was 2019 and we had Epics now, I mean, that business alone would be worth hundreds of millions or billions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. At the time, the industry was only so big, and it was certainly a game changer. Actually, the agents didn't want to give it to us. They didn't like us much at the time. They grew to love me, but at the time, they didn't like us much because we were this big, horrible, you know, thing up. Got all the US software houses, but the Epics guys told them to do the deal with us, so...
What did you look for in a title when you were choosing a release for US Gold?
Well, it changed. You know, say in the earlier days, we were looking for one great product from a range from an American brand. And then when the coin-op business started, you know, I was very lucky. You know, I was going to all the coin-op shows in New Orleans, you know, Tokyo. And we were just looking for the biggest, the biggest coin-ops. We took a lot that we thought would be big and weren't big because we were trying to... Again, it was this kind of mopping up thing. In the same way we were mopping up everything from America, our goal was to mop up everything from the coin-op industry. The one thing that people either know or didn't know is Ocean, the directors of Ocean, also shareholders of US Gold. I mean, that was a deal Jeff regretted every day of his life, I think, after that, because they got 50% of the company for putting in £50,000 back in 84, I think, to start US Gold. Yeah. And so we had a thing with Ocean that we wouldn't go after their labels and they wouldn't come after ours. So like we went after Sega, which is the biggest, and several others. They went after Taito and others. So we never competed. So nobody could play off US Gold against Ocean. So Ocean got the best and we got most of the best as well. I mean, Activision was there trying to get licenses. British Telecom were there trying to get licenses, but we got most of them because, you know, we were just this powerhouse.
I remember, you know, as a kid having the US Gold release of Outrun, the poster on my bedroom wall. And yeah. I think that was like the first time I had movie posters, but that was the first time I had a video game poster on my wall. And that was like, right. That seemed like a big change. And I mean, bringing that kind of huge coin-op hit home. I mean, was that kind of a bit of a challenge bringing these, like, you know, massive arcade games to the British home computer platforms? Like, I always wondered what Sega thought of, like, the Spectrum port of Outrun, for example.
Well, it's funny, a guy that I later worked with, a guy called Justin Heber, he was at the shows as well. He was working for Virgin at the time, Virgin Games at the time. And, I mean, they didn't get much, if anything, actually, only the stuff that we didn't want. I mean, he sent me a picture of me looking at Outrun, and he put a note on it saying, "No, Tim, it won't fit on a Spectrum." Right. I wish I had it, actually. But, I mean, Outrun was just the biggest thing. It was just amazing. We had to get it and we had to try. And I think we made it, you know, with Fergus McGovern, rest in peace, you know, we made a pretty decent game out of it. The fact that we were going to take something that, you know, cost $5,000, you know, dollars as a cabinet and put it into a Spectrum and it was going to look like it was going to look on a Spectrum, we didn't think about that because our business was our business, you know, and we delivered good code and we delivered bad code. You know, Gauntlet was another one. You know, Gauntlet was a Christmas number one, like Outrun was. You know, when we got that, people said, that's not going to work, you know, and it was great. It worked fantastically well. It was a fantastic conversion, but, you know, you were delivering something else. We weren't there to deliver Outrun the coin up. We were there to deliver an adaptation of it onto a Sinclair and a Commodore 64 and an Amstrad. How big it was, whether it was Operation Wolf with two machine guns or Outrun with a Ferrari, it didn't make any difference. It was just what our game was going to be.
What was US Gold's relationship with the magazines like?
Well, we were big advertisers. I mean, in fact, we had a deal to book so many ads every month that we sometimes just didn't have the products to, you know, to fill these slots. I mean, with Newsfield, which had Zap and Crash, I think we were going to do 10 ads a month. That was the days of, you know, Julian and Gary Penn and those guys down there. Yeah, you never really knew whether that was buying you a lot of favors, but I guess, you know, we're all human beings, you know, and, you know, at the end of the day, advertising pays the bills, not good reviews or bad reviews. They just, you know, sell some magazines. And then, you know, the circulation numbers of these magazines were not, you know, enormous in those days. And maybe that bought us some favors. You know, we had a good relationship with, most magazines through Danielle Woody, who's still there today and still doing the same thing today. And she never touched a game in her life. She wouldn't know how to play a game if it fell on her head. But that, you know, it was about... it was about that kind of personal touch and being not motherly because she wasn't that much older than these guys, but that kind of that special relationship.
Well, speaking of her as well, I mean, I remember, you know, reading stories about how she'd kind of go into maybe a magazine and kind of they'd look at one of the games and not be a big fan of it. But within an hour, she'd kind of talk them round and it actually got like a glowing review at the end. I mean, she was kind of like, it seemed like the face of the company in the magazines. Was that kind of planned?
Oh, no, she definitely was. I mean, she definitely was. Personally, I wasn't involved in that part of the business. She had a guy working for her called Richard Titzel as well. But she won. I think we had three or four people in PR because, you know, if you remember at the time, what was advertising? It was an image, three screenshots, a little bit of text, and if we could drag a couple of good quotes that we may have taken out of context accidentally from time to time, you know, like the greatest game in the world, but it's crap, but we just put the, you know, greatest game in the world part. There was nothing, you know, advertising, you couldn't do a lot with advertising. It was very, you know, there was nothing like we have nowadays, you know, so it was all about PR. It was all about getting good reviews, you know, likewise a bad review. You would, I mean, a couple of bad reviews in Newsfield, you know, you were dead. I mean, so PR was the most vital part of the marketing department at the time.
Well, kind of moving on from US Gold, and let's get into Virgin then, because I know you joined them in 1991. I mean, initially you were the managing director for the European division of Virgin Games. Mm-hmm. How did it come about then, you going to work at Virgin?
Well, that's another strange one. I left US Gold in 1989 because I felt I'd done everything, and by then, you know, we had obviously a lot of staff and it was kind of really processed and it was really boring. And so I was offered an opportunity to start my own company with some guys in the US. It was called Tech Magic. And it was going to be a Sega Master System publisher because we had relationships with Sega. The company actually represented Sega in Europe, Positronic. And all from Frank Herrmann. Frank Herrmann, everybody in the industry knew Frank. He was a Virgin, you know, Mastertronic, and then Virgin Mastertronic, and then he went on to GTI and lots of things. And rest in peace, he passed away in 2009. And he rang me up and said, "Tim, there's a, you know, job down at Virgin. You know, are you interested? They're looking for an MD down there." And I said, "Well, not really, Frank. You know, I've got my own company, and you know, we've got games coming out. Could make a lot of money." And Virgin at the time, you know, I mean, pretty crap. I mean, they had Archer MacLean's snooker coming out, but really there was, I mean, it was a very small company. I had like 16 employees and, you know, and I wasn't that keen on it. So I went, anyway, he said, "Well, come down and have lunch with Robert Devereaux." Robert was Richard's brother-in-law. I liked Robert a lot and I think he liked me, but I still wasn't sure. I still wasn't sure. I've given up kind of my own company, which inevitably is what you kind of need to do if you want to make serious money. And I stalled it kind of for 6 months with Robert. I couldn't make my mind up. And I had lunch with him sometime in late-ish 91. And we sat down at a restaurant in Notting Hill. And he said, "Tim," he said, "before I order, before we even order starters, are you coming or not?" And I was like, that's what you call a close. You know, yeah. So you're sitting down for lunch and nobody's ordering. You know, basically say, if I said, "Well, I don't think so, Robert," then the lunch was off. There's no point in wasting his time and money buying me lunch. Being the, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And I said, "Yeah, I got one proviso." And it was about commission on Sega cartridges, which I had with the company I was working, my own company kind of. And yeah, so that's how it came about, really. And I joined and I thought, well, you know, what a lot of scruffy load of herbets this lot are, all in jeans and t-shirts. And but in the end, I became one of them, although I was probably better dressed than most of them. And out of the 19 people there, I got rid of 17 or 16. Got lucky because at the same time, Mirrorsoft went out of business and I was able to get Sean Brennan. He was able to bring some great Mirrorsoft producers, so and some studios that were working with Mirrorsoft, you know. So we got off to a great start. We were, you know, 1 minute I was there with, you know, a bunch of guys that I didn't really kind of want to be with. Next minute I got Sean, I got products from Sensible Software with Jobs and those guys, and we had a kind of portfolio to start working on.
Well, Virgin were kind of famed for their rock and roll history with stuff like the Sex Pistols and, you know, all their original kind of music. Was it good joining a wider company with culture?
Well, it was a fantastic culture. You could basically do anything behind that brand. And people think, "Oh, it's Virgin. Yeah, okay." You know, we really pushed it on marketing and lots of other things. But you know, the European company I joined, you know, had less than $1 million of revenue that the previous year. And we got it up to 200 million by 1993, in about 2.5 years, we got up to 200 million. And that's because we say we got some of the Mirosoft products, we got CoinOp products, you know, games were coming out of America like Seventh Guest. And it was great. I say you could do anything. I mean, we gave the best parties, and people, obviously people, I mean, a lot of people tried to copy us, you know, copy our advertising style, which was controversial. You know, we were there to kind of shock you into buying products like Resident Evil, Doom 2, you know, all of these have got their own kind of stories. But then when people tried to copy us, our style, if there wasn't a Virgin logo there, it was kind of like, it was like a misfit. It didn't look right that someone like Interplay would do a teddy bear with a shotgun, somebody firing a shotgun through it. It looked like, okay, they're trying to be Virgin. Then GTI were using our kind of ad style, and it just didn't look right. But when we did it, it was like, yeah, these are Virgin. These guys can get away with it.
We kind of got a bit of an insight into that when we had Archie MacLean on the show, actually. He was talking to us about how he took Jimmy White on tour when World Wind Snooker came out, and they ended up going to Richard Branson's house. And, Richard got Jimmy so drunk that he couldn't even, like, hold a snooker cue anymore. I mean, how much of that kind of excess really happened in the company then? I mean, did it kind of fit in with its rock and roll image?
Well, I think by 95, we were completely out of control. You know, hedonism, sex, drugs, and video games had become, like an everyday thing. I'm not saying we took drugs every single day, but it became completely hedonistic. You know, and by then we'd sold the company to Blockbuster. Blockbuster left us alone. We were getting bigger and bigger and dominating in France and dominating in Germany. I had the rest of the world outside of America by then. So I had Japan and Singapore and Australia and everywhere in between. And we were living the life, you know, we were there to have fun, but at the same time, and it makes us sound like we were completely mental and out of control. We weren't out of control. I mean, I coined it as kind of loosely managed anarchy at the time. But at the same time, we were doing our job. We were making massive hits with Resident Evil, Command & Conquer 1, and many others. You know, so we were still, you know, we were still out there along with Electronic Arts, you know, dominating the business. Equal with Electronic Arts, bigger than Electronic Arts in Germany, actually, at the time.
Well, you think of the 90s, and it was stuff like, you know, The Word and, like, Loaded, I remember, and it was that lad and ladette kind of culture as well. So it kind of, I guess it felt like Virgin kind of fitted in with its time very much.
Well, it did. If you remember Viz,
yeah,
which is still around today, I mean, Virgin Mastertronic, in launching the Sega hardware, used Viz extensively, and Loaded, of course. But so we did fit. I mean, the 90s itself as a decade, when you read books on the 90s, it was a decade of decadence, of self-belief and self-interest, self-servitude kind of thing, you know, making it, that was the decade. I mean, anything went really anywhere. I mean, we did get into a lot of trouble with advertising, but then we didn't care, you know, that's okay. You know, we've done the job. Because it always took the Advertising Standards Authority about 3 weeks to ban an advert.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, actually, because, you know, nowadays it's kind of standard to have edgy advertising, and back in the days, you got 6 successive campaigns kind of taken down by the Advertising Standards Authority.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it was 6 or more, actually. I always quote 13, but I may have been, you know, exaggerating. We did. We had successive ones banned. We had complaints from the French government. I can't remember all the ads that were banned, but we did one called Famous Mass Murderers. We had, obviously, Stalin, Genghis Khan, Hitler, and we put Jack Chirac in on there because he was testing atomic bombs in the French atoll.
Wow.
And so the French embassy, you know, went to the Advertising Standards and said, look at this advert with Jack Chirac on it. And they said, yeah, you've got to take the ad down. So actually what we did, we got a picture of someone else, and I can't remember who it was, and just went round to every billboard. This was 48 sheet billboard sites at the time, and just stuck somebody else over Jack Chirac and left it there.
And people peeled them off, I imagine.
Possibly. I couldn't comment on that. Screamer was another one. We had a game called Screamer. And at the time, there was a lot of joyriding. It was a big social problem at the time. And Screamer, you know, it wasn't so much the picture, which was obviously like a kind of a 1996 ASBO at the time. Our text about, you know, putting your foot down, hammering it, smash it. I mean, that was banned pretty quickly.
I even remember reading stories about, I don't know how true these are and whether you can talk about it, but about Virgin kind of bribing game reviewers and, you know, maybe even stories of like drugs being included with discs of the game to magazines and that kind of thing. I mean, was there any of that?
Well, I don't think we did. I mean, by then we had Woody. I mean, I took several people from US Gold because my first objective was to destroy US Gold with Virgin, and I did. If you see that US Gold got sold for nothing in 93 or 4. So I took Woody, I took Bob Kenrick, I took Sue Luciano, I took LucasArts. You know, I started to kind of, I mean, all because there was an award thing called the Indin at the time. It was a Christmas do. It was a real piss take and thing. And you know, Jeff won US Software House of the Year. I wasn't there. And he said, you know, three things have happened great for US Gold this year, and da-da-da and da-da-da, and Tim Chaney left. You know, so I thought, okay, well, we'll see. You know, so and with the Virgin power and Virgin money and everybody wanting to work for Virgin, really. I mean, it was a great article that Stuart Dinsey did back in 2005 about Virgin, and everybody says, you know, Simon Jeffrey, Woody, everybody says it was the best job they ever had, which is great because it probably was. It's my best job ever. And, you know, so I don't think we sent drugs. We certainly sent animal innards to people. But I don't know. Honestly, I don't. I'm not trying to avoid it, because if I knew we did, I'd say, yeah, we did. What the hell? But I don't know if we did that.
You must have been to quite a lot of launch parties as well, considering the amount of titles coming out. What were the wildest ones like? Were there some good ones?
The thing that we always did at the time, there was a big show at Olympia every year. Is it called ECTS when it moved from Islington to Olympia, and it became a totally different thing, becoming like an American big stand thing. And we always went completely overboard on the stand. We had naked women outside. Was the stand to go and have a look at or stare at, depending on, you know, what you were looking for. Launch parties, I guess we had loads. I mean, I just can't remember. We always had a Christmas party, obviously, like most companies, that was, it was just completely, it's just mental. You know, I didn't feel safe there myself, and I was the MD, one place we flooded.
Wow.
You know, somewhere in the city. But the launch parties specifically, I honestly can't remember. We took over a manor house somewhere in Buckinghamshire, and we turned it into a kind of haunted house, and we put all the kind of seventh guest clues around the house, and so journalists and other people. That was a really good one. That was a really good. I mean, Seventh Guest, again, was the first, probably along with Myst, you know, the first true CD-ROM interactive game, although it was a puzzle game with live video. But it was, you know, I think it was the one product that Richard came to my office and personally promoted. Got a picture of him and me together with the game.
Well, how hands-on was Richard with the company?
He wasn't very hands-on. I mean, I met him several times, and I used to go down to Holland Park to his house. It was one of those strange meetings, because he would be sitting in a settee, I'd be sitting opposite him. He'd ask me about the business, and while I was answering these questions, people would come in with checks to sign, papers to sign, and I think I kind of got this from him, that, you know, Errol was talking about this and that, and Australia, and isn't it great, and that, but he only kind of picked up the piece that he could see that was good for him. Right, and at the time it's about aeroplanes, Virgin Atlantic, you know. So I remember picking up about playing games on planes, which at the time didn't exist, and he asked about whether he could get kind of Nintendos in planes and stuff like that. So he picked he just picked up the piece of all that thing that he's probably going to use for himself. But I remember being in his house, and his front door was open, and I said, you know, Richard, as I was leaving, Richard, your front door's open. He said, yes, okay. He said, if they're going to get you, they're going to get you. Right? I mean, there's no security. I mean, nothing. It was just a house. He had two houses side by side.
Well, talking about, I mean, you mentioned Seventh Guest before. You know, the games that Virgin brought out, I mean, you know, we think about the image and everything that they had, but there was some amazing titles that the company published as well. I mean, you know, Cannon Fodder and Cool Spot, I remember, you know, the 7-Up game, that was a great platform. Yeah. Lion King you had too. I mean, there were some really strong titles coming out. I mean, any kind of memorable stories or memories about those titles that came out?
Well, I remember Lion King. I mean, we started working with Disney. I had the first meeting with them. They had the Aladdin film coming out and was stuck. And we got David Perry coded that in 4 months and that became a massive hit. I remember Lion King cost us $10 million as a guarantee. And, you know, it became a big hit. Command & Conquer, a massive hit. Resident Evil, I did a deal with Capcom for 10 products, unseen. And one of them was something called Biohazard, which I'd never... You know, it was just another name. I was there to get Capcom to blow up US Gold because they had Capcom up to that point, and I was just going to blow them out of the water with at the time a $2 million offer, which was a lot of money. And US Gold certainly was starting to run out of money by then. And they had this game called Biohazard, and it turned out to be Resident Evil, which, you know, it was just a name on a list of 10 games that they're going to give us the license for. And, you know, so, you know, deals... getting LucasArts was a major thing, although we didn't have their whole of Europe. It was the same agents that did Epics, so they kind of split it up all over the place. We did have a lot of tremendous, I mean, Cool Spot. We did a game for McDonald's called Global Gladiators.
Yeah.
Right. which I can't remember if they paid for. We certainly had the Golden Arches in it. And with the same code, Dave Perry did Cool Spot. And when Sega saw Cool Spot, I remember it's a function we did in Palm Beach, Florida, where we had Muhammad Ali, Virginia Wade, lots and lots of famous, famous golfers and sports people. They saw Cool Spot, and Barry Jafrato at the time he just saw it and went mental for it. I mean, I think we sold, I don't know, 600,000 in Europe. And that was a game based on a can of soft drink.
Yeah.
Global Gladiators didn't sell, by the way. You know, it's one of these pathetic things, like it's kind of like Eco Warriors, which, as we know, McDonald's is about as least eco as you can possibly find.
Well, companies like Hasbro, Viacom, and Blockbuster all bought shares in Virgin. Did the company kind of change when this happened?
Not a lot, really. Because when we were finally, I mean, Hasbro bought shares, then Blockbuster bought shares, then Blockbuster bought out Hasbro, and Blockbuster bought the entire company. They left us alone. They put us under Spelling Entertainment, Aaron Spelling's unit, which they bought the previous year. Left us alone, really. They didn't touch us. I mean, the people that started touching the business was Viacom, when Viacom bought Blockbuster. Viacom didn't like the business at all. You know, they'd already written off $100 million of their own money in Viacom New Media. So they didn't like the games business. And I remember one E3, I had to show Sumner Redstone around the show. Can you imagine the pressure of that? Sumner Redstone, owner of Viacom, come to E3, and I had to show him around the stand and to other people's stands. I mean, God, I couldn't do it now. I'd have a heart attack. I always remember his trousers. He had like kind of beige trousers. They were like 5 inches too short.
No way.
And this was a guy that's worth, I don't know, 30 billion, you know. So anyway, so they didn't interfere, but Viacom did. Viacom didn't want the business. They put us on the road to sell us. And we were a hard thing to sell because, unlike most at the time, you know, the US are like 75% of business and Europe is 25% of people, you know, people like EA and Activision and everyone else. But we were different to that. We were 75% of our business was international, and only 25% was Europe. Was America. So therefore, we didn't kind of fit anybody. In the end, Electronic Arts bought the Westwood studio and a load of other assets. I did a management buyout after that, which Viacom paid me $8 million to take off the hands, actually.
So why did you leave eventually then?
Oh, we sold it. We sold it the next year.
Yeah.
We bought it for nothing. Plus $8 million from Viacom, plus them writing off a $7 million debt. Next year we sold it to Titus. And I met a Spanish girl, and I was getting married. So I moved to Spain. I had a 2.5 year golden parachute. Basically, if I don't, I mean, they were paying me, but, you know, just to hang around. as long as I didn't do anything, they would pay me at the end of the time. So I came to Spain and eventually bought, you know, the Spanish business from them when they got in trouble in 2002, 2003, because, yeah, it was just bad. It became really bad. I mean, they lost the Virgin brand, for one thing, which they would never. So I went to Richard. I remember calling him, he was in the bath, and said, Richard Timchea, I said, I bought this company in Spain, Virgin Interactive Entertainment España. We're going to lose the Virgin name because you did, right? I said, can I get it again? He said, sure. We called it Virgin Play, which I wish I had now because that name was fantastic. You know, Virgin Play at the time was, okay, good, but nowadays that name would be awesome.
Well, I mean, you know, you got so many great stories from your time at Virgin. I know, I do remember seeing a couple of years ago, you're going to write these down into a book. I mean, is there still kind of a plan for you to do that at some point?
Well, I tell you what, I watched Wolf of Wall Street. And I'm not comparing myself with him or anything he did or, well, most things he did. I'm not comparing myself with him. And I thought, well, the Virgin story is a great story because not only the business side, you know, how this 1 million became 200 million, sold for $250 million, equal to Electronic Arts, bigger than NBO. So, I mean, the business history, how those, like the games you've mentioned, like Seventh Guest, Command and Conquer, all those things came through. But the other side was this kind of hedonistic thing that, which I say by 1995 was really, I mean, I remember the guys from America came over, you know, and had a chat with me on the side saying, Tim, watch it, you know, Viacom are looking. And my lawyer tried to get me fired, but she got fired. And the number two at Viacom said he'd like to go over to England and kneecap me.
Wow.
And then he gave me a pay increase because they were trying to sell the company and I had Capcom in my pocket because Capcom was down to me, personal relationship. And so I just, it'd be a great book. The thing is that it was kind of, I was going to do something on Kickstarter. I wanted 50,000 because it's, you know about writing books, right? I mean, it's a long, hard job. So I wasn't going to do it for nothing. I've done a book for nothing. It's called Luton Boy, about growing up in Luton. And, you know, it was in me and I just wanted to get right here. And people liked the book and everything else. But, and it got off to, you know, good funding. Dave Perry put some money in. And I mean, the first guy to put money was actually Simon Byron. But there were people out there trying to scupper it because they didn't want those stories coming out because they were now parents with children of their own. And it wasn't but people, even if I changed the names, people would say, well, that's him. Oh, that's him. You know, so, you know, and I just stopped. There was no point. There were too many people that didn't want the book to be, and people powerful that didn't want the book to come out. So, you know, one day maybe somebody will walk in the door and say, Tim, here's a 50,000. Go and write it. Go and write it. You know, just like the bitmaps. Bitmap publishing or something—I don't know, but I don't know. I mean, it would be an amazing book. It would be a fantastic book, and it would be such a thing of the times, and of one company that under the headline Virgin got away with blue murder, and just try. You know, we didn't accept anybody's rules. We expect apart from you made a disc, and the disc was round, and it went in a box. I mean, that was it. Everything else we were making up. We were doing something different. We were trying things. Of course, things don't work. You know, some things, they backfire on you. But at the time, we were trying anything to be distinctive, to be different.
Well, as I say, you know, you can't keep a good story down. Hopefully, we will get the full story at some point in the future.
Well, I might get assassinated before then, but anyway. Yeah.
What are you doing these days then, Tim? So I know you're in Spain. What's kind of your life these days?
Nowadays, I act for studios looking for money. Which, you know, can be a soulless task, as we all know, because money's money. Mm. You know, so I've got several studios. I go to, you know, several hundred publishers. I look at state funds. You know, I try and find money for studios, you know, games. I quite like doing it. Everything takes 10 times longer than you want, which frustrates Alamy, because in my day, somebody walked in with a game and said, I want a game. We want X thousand for this game. You'd sign it up in the afternoon. Life is not like that anymore. But no, I quite like doing it. I meet some nice people, and I've got some really great products. You know, I mean, they're probably a year away now, but really good products.
Well, Tim, it's been wonderful reminiscing with you. Thank you so much for sharing those incredible stories about, you know, those companies that we grew up, you know, idolizing so much back then and shaping our childhoods as well. So it's been great to have you on this week.
I really enjoyed the walk down memory lane, and some of the kind of things you picked out were, I mean, there's probably 100 more that there's a story behind it. As I say, maybe I'll write up one day, but you picked some good stuff, and they were about how the industry evolved, and obviously U.S. Gold emerges part in it, but they were all kind of evolutionary points of change, things that were changing the business, and now I've created this business that what we have now, which is a monster. Anyway.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Tim.
I enjoyed it.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.